I don't know. I mean, honestly, I don't know. Yes, there is economic news, and we're going to tell you about it. But man, that high school in Florida, huh? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Wednesday today, 14 February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I'm going to be honest with you here as we get going. I hate days like this, days where there has been a shooting in a school or at a concert. It's not our story, right? There is no marketplace angle, but you can't ignore it. So we are going to acknowledge it, trust that you have had your fill of it elsewhere, and turn to our news of this Wednesday. It came in directly at 8:30 this morning with a much-anticipated but kind of, honestly, underwhelming report on inflation, the Consumer Price Index, as it's known, up a bit, but nowhere near as drastic as we'd all expected it to be. Nevertheless, one more data point for policymakers to consider as they figure out how to try to steer this economy. As it happens, one of those policymakers came by Marketplace World headquarters today. Robert Kaplan is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, also a member, by the way, of the Federal Open Market Committee. It sets interest rates, as you might know if you listen to this broadcast. Mr. Kaplan, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Got to start with the news of the day, inflation, consumer price index. Lots of hullabaloo about inflation and oh my God, the last week, 10 days. Are we more worried about that than we ought to be?
Well, we're at the stage in the cycle with unemployment at 4.1, 4.2%, and we think heading into the threes. Cyclical inflation pressures are building. I would expect the Fed will be making progress in reaching its 2% target during this year and next year. I think cyclical inflationary forces are building.
Just to get it out of the way, you think the Fed's going to raise interest rates probably three times this year?
Well, my base case, we're trained at the Fed. I don't speak for the whole group. I speak for myself. But my own view right now is, and base case is, that we should be removing accommodation three times this year. And we'll see how the economy unfolds during the year, whether it's more or less.
I'm going to translate the econ speak, even though you're not actually an economist. Removing accommodation means raising
the Fed funds.
There
rate.
You go.
That's right.
Let me ask you about the volatility of the last week, 10 days, induced by that inflation fear. You have said it's healthy, and I'm not going to disagree with you, but I think what you mean is it's healthy that we let a little air out of the balloon.
Well, let's take it in pieces. Before this sell-off, we've gone 15 straight months basically without a 3% correction, and that hasn't happened in a very long time. In fact, you have a hard time finding in history when that's happened. The closest I can find maybe is the late 50s. And so anytime I've learned from being in the markets my whole career, you see something you've never seen before or you haven't seen in 50 years, it tells you that probably there needs to be some adjustment. So I wouldn't have wished for the type of volatility
saw. Right? It was a speed with which it happened.
But,
1,000 points.
But I would also say to people, if volatility is somewhat higher when it settles out and there's more up and down in the market, that would be more typical of what I've experienced. The last 15 months, I would say, was atypical.
Since you mentioned it, the tax bill, the amount of debt that we're incurring in this economy going over the next 8 to 10 years, are you concerned?
Yeah, I am concerned. And so I've talked about three big issues, structural issues that I'm worried about. Aging demographics, i.e. the workforce is getting older and workforce growth is slowing. Number two, we are lagging in this country in terms of education and skill levels. And then the third thing I worry about, we've deleveraged at the consumer level since the Great Recession.
Consumers are borrowing less and paying off
debt. But we are more highly leveraged than we've ever been at the government level. And the recent legislation, part of it, the corporate tax reform, I think may help sustainable growth. But a big part of this legislation was a tax cut funded by increasing the debt, which is going to give us a short-term bump in GDP.
Yep.
And then we're going to get back down to trend growth over the next year or two, except we're going to be more leveraged. And ultimately, we've got to moderate this debt growth.
We're going to have more debt with the same old consistent 2-ish to 2.3% growth.
Yeah. And the reason that's my concern. And the reason, by the way, GDP is made up of two things, growth in the workforce, growth in productivity. And again, with aging, workforce growth is likely to be sluggish. productivity isn't going to make up for the slow workforce growth. And then you add a third thing. We're highly leveraged.
Yeah.
That's a bad combination.
As the guy responsible for the Dallas Fed, but also as a member, non-voting this time, of the Federal Open Market Committee, what keeps you up at night?
Really, that we're not talking enough about these big structural drivers. So there's cyclical things, inflation, yep, unemployment.
Right.
The news tends to get obsessed with these cyclical things, and those are the things that I want to make sure we're spending more attention on in this country.
Do you think? I mean, you're talking about it, and I'm talking about it. Millions of people are going to hear this. Are we not talking about it enough, or are people not listening enough?
So our policies need to match up with these issues. So if I told you immigrants and their children made up over half the workforce growth in the United States over the last 20 years, yeah, you would say, yes, let's toughen the borders, let's improve the scoring. But if we think we're going to grow GDP by shrinking immigration, we should rethink that. You would also say, let's really have a national initiative to improve educational attainment, early childhood literacy, and skills development. And then thirdly, you'd say, at this stage in the cycle, when we should be reducing debt to GDP, because we know in a recession, yep, leverage goes up,
yep,
let's be very careful about trying to reduce debt to GDP when times are good, or moderate debt growth, because you don't want to be doing that when you're in a recession. That's not the time to be doing it.
That was part one of Bob Kaplan, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Part two coming up in just a bit, the second half of the show, on some of the bigger picture issues he's thinking about. On Wall Street today, I'll tell you what, when Mr. Kaplan sat down in the studio, first thing he did, no joke, was ask where the yield on the 10-year Treasury note was. So I told him. Stock traders, meanwhile, looked at that inflation report today and said, that doesn't scare me. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If the inflation number this morning didn't set off any real alarm bells, which it didn't, there was another economic data point out today that raised some eyebrows. Hot off the keyboards from the Commerce Department, we learned retail spending in January was lower than it was a month earlier. Nothing huge, off 0.3%. But we mention it because everybody had been guessing that retail sales would actually be higher. No, a single data point does not a trend make, but seeing how consumers have been oh so confident of late, we asked Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson to dig in a little bit and see what's going on.
The retail sales report is made up of a long list of spending in a bunch of different categories. So it's full of these up and down spending arrows, red and green economic lights. For example, the American consumer spent less on automobiles in January than December, less on furniture and building supplies. Those were big drags in this report. On the other hand, consumers spent more on gas and clothes.
Electronic stores did well, and department stores did surprisingly well.
Chris Christopher is the executive director of IHS Market. Sum it all up, and Christopher says this report is a bit disappointing, but not troubling. Retail spending is still significantly higher now than this time last year.
So there is a little bit of life there in the consumer. And what we sort of think is maybe they're just taking a little bit of a breather after a very good holiday retail sales season.
The holiday season was so robust, it's not that surprising. There wasn't as much activity in January.
Barbara Kahn is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School.
They're also speculating random events like maybe the flu was worse or the weather might not have been, you know, the kind of weather that incents people to go shopping.
Bottom line, this is a blip, not a warning sign, says Steve Odland with the Conference Board.
It's a tiny speed bump in a steady, accelerating economy, and I wouldn't read too much into it.
If we were to see a string of similar reports in coming months, well, then that'd be a different story. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
You know that thing we say all the time about businesses really just wanting certainty in economic policy so that they can get on with things? The Trump administration has been a frustrating experience for businesses in that regard, and trade policy specifically. Some of the things the White House was pretty big on early days have fallen by the wayside. Other ideas that seem to be dead are back, just rebranded. Remember the border adjustment tax from last year? Dead till yesterday, brought back as a reciprocal tax on imports. That's the word. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, we are out, but at Davos, the president said, we might reconsider. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams looks at the high cost to businesses when the White House can't seem to pin things down.
The Trump administration is up against the classic trade dilemma: protect domestic producers or manufacturers who rely on cheap imports.
So it's an administration that is really more divided on this issue than just about any other economic issue.
Jason Furman is a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School. Trump says he wants a better deal in terms of trade and tariffs, but the mixed messages coming out of the White House are creating uncertainty.
So you see different businesses react in different ways, sometimes with real unintended consequences for the economy as a whole.
Like last year, when Trump threatened new tariffs on imported steel to protect domestic producers. Manufacturers who rely on those imports reminded him the move would threaten jobs in their industries. Yesterday, he said he's considering all options. That was encouraging for Kimberly Corbel of the American Wire Producers Association.
We listen to what he has to say, and we make sure that we have a good, strong position, and we communicate that message to the best of our ability.
But what's encouraging for her can be frustrating for others.
I'll be honest, it's been very challenging to align your expectations with the rhetoric of the administration.
Scott Paul is with the Alliance for American Manufacturers, which represents domestic steel and aluminum producers.
The president promised swift action. Instead, through the delays, the president opened up our market for a surge of imports.
Imports some businesses wanted to have as a buffer against the uncertainty. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
All right, so how about this? Netflix and a big giant paycheck. Forget the chill. The company has made a deal to bring the award-winning producer Ryan Murphy into the fold and create a bunch of bingeable series and movies. 5 years on that deal, a reported $300 million. It's the streaming giant's latest move to book top-level talent. Less than a year ago, you might remember, it signed an estimated $100 million four-year deal with Shonda Rhimes. That bit of gender pay disparity aside, Netflix is clearly doubling down on original content, as Marketplace's Renata Sego reports.
Some of Netflix's biggest successes have been its award-winning original series and films.
The animal.
Think Orange is the New Black or the Golden Globe Award-nominated Mudbound. The streaming giant's vast library of new, exclusively owned content has attracted subscribers and retained them. That's why this deal with Ryan Murphy is attractive, says Daniel Ives. He's chief strategy officer at the market research firm GBH Insights.
When you have Disney, Amazon, you know, potentially other entrants coming down the pike, Apple could be one. Netflix has to continue to spend on content and spend aggressively.
Ives predicts Netflix will spend $8 billion this year on deals with other big creatives, including writers and editors. Amanda Lotz teaches media studies at the University of Michigan. She finds shelling out big dollars on big-name producers is a risk. Who's to say, for example, their content, backed by traditional television studios, will be as good in a new environment?
Very famous people make shows that flop, and people you've never heard from make big successes.
But big names bring strong followings. And for Netflix, that could be the key to boosting subscribers across demographics, says Brett Sappington. He researches pay TV for Parks Associates.
They're trying to hedge that risk by getting those people that have proven over time or through different types of content that they've produced that they can come up with a hit across different types of genres.
That may mean smaller name producers have less of a shot at fame for now. I'm Renata Sego for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Across most of the Muslim world, in nearly every single country, there are more women coming out of university than men.
And more women than ever in the workplace as well. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added 1% today, about 253 points, 24,893 on the blue chips. NASDAQ gained 1.8%, 130 points, 7143. S&P 500 up 1.3%, 35 points, 2698. Bond yield rose today on the heels of that CPI report that Bob Kaplan was asking me about. Good for banks that can charge more to borrow money. Shares of Bank America lifted 2.6% today. J.P. Morgan Chase up 2.3%. Citigroup deposited 2%. News that Taco Bell's former CEO is going to lead Chipotle Mexican Grill was a heaping of extra toppings for Chipotle stock. It soared 15.3% today. Yum Brands, which owns Taco Bell, added about 0.1%. So to bonds, the prices fell. That means yields go up. 10-year Treasury note stands at 2.91%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We're going to pick up with the rest of my interview with Bob Kaplan, now the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. We touched on the markets at the top of the show, also the realities of fiscal policy in this economy right now. Part two is more, I guess you'd say, 30,000 feet-ish. Here you go. A couple of sort of macro issues, big picture issues I want to run by you. The first is America and the global trade environment. You represent the Dallas Fed, very close to Mexico. There's NAFTA renegotiations going on.
Yeah.
The White House is making no secret of its disdain for multilateral international agreements.
I'll be in Mexico Friday.
Have a lovely trip. How worried are you?
So I spent a lot of time in Mexico, and the Dallas Fed, we have a history of being very close to Mexico. We're the largest exporting state in the country.
Huh.
And so—
To Mexico?
No, in general. We're the largest exporting state in the country, period, Texas is. Mexico is our largest trading partner, but we do a lot of research on trade. And the bottom line, I've said publicly, based on our research, we would be well served to segment our trading relationships. What do I mean by that? Our trading relationship with Mexico is primarily an intermediate goods relationship. 70% of the imports to the U.S. from Mexico are intermediate goods, not final goods. They're goods that are going back and forth across the border 15, 20 times as part of complicated logistics and supply chain arrangements.
Pair of jeans going to get stitched and sewn and decorated and back and forth.
Car assembly, name it.
Got it.
Some work done here, some there. What it's allowed U.S. companies to do is keep plants here in the United States and add jobs here. And it's made this hemisphere, i.e. North America, much more globally competitive. If we didn't have that trading relationship with Mexico, in our judgment, we'd likely lose many of those jobs elsewhere in the world, probably to Asia. We need to be thinking about North America as a competitive hemisphere that competes with Europe, competes with Asia, and segment our relationships.
Well, yeah, but when the president says, listen, I'm going to get us out of NAFTA because it stinks, and we don't want to be in TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because they're robbing us blind, or whatever it is that he says, then what goes through your mind?
The trading relationship with Mexico is strategically vital. The trading relationship with Mexico has improved U.S. competitiveness, and that part, I think, shouldn't be lost on this decision-making.
Globalization, you have said, 10 or 15 years ago might have been a threat. Now it's an opportunity, you say.
We're about 5% of the world's population. If we're going to grow, we need to be more integrated with the world. And I think we've now made the adjustments in this country to get the benefits of globalization. Too often, if there's a disruption in a town or a company, it's being blamed on globalization. It's much more likely today technology-enabled disruption that's happening within our borders. And I think if we get that diagnosis wrong, we're going to make poor policy decisions.
Let me take you back to your pre-Fed civilian life. You taught at Harvard. You wrote extensively on leadership. So I want to now merge the two paths. Explain to me and characterize for me the leadership challenge that Jerome Powell now faces as the Fed chair.
Well, and Jay is, I think—
I call him Mr. Powell.
Yeah, it's okay. Jay is a fantastic choice to lead the Fed. I've been working intensively with him for the last 2.5 years. The most important from a leadership point of view, you've got to be an authoritative analyst of the economy in your own right. He is. And then you've got to be good at forging a consensus among all of us around the table. Whether we vote or not, we all have input into this decision. I think Jay's great at both. I think the most important leadership quality I've learned you need to have as a central banker, but that's been true in my past life, but it's particularly true, is an openness to learning, willingness to face reality, adapt, and say, I've changed my mind, or I'd like your advice, or maybe I was wrong, is not a bad thing to be able to say, and adapt to a changing reality. I think Jay's very well equipped to do that. But I also, even for myself, I remind myself of that every day. That those are important skills you need to have in this job.
Robert Kaplan, president of the Dallas Fed. Thanks a lot for coming in.
All right. Great to talk to you, Kai.
Demography, as they say, is destiny. That's true for the politics of any given economy, and it is true also for economies writ large. Who's in your workforce matters a whole lot. And across the Muslim world, that is increasingly women. Sadia Zahidi is the head of education, gender, and work at the World Economic Forum. Her new book on that topic is called 50 Million Rising. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I want to start where you start in this book. You're a kid, you're like 10 years old, and you go out with your dad in Pakistan somewhere. He's a petroleum engineer, right? And you go out for a day with him?
A geophysicist, working in the oil and gas industry.
And you get out there and you find this thing that I guess fundamentally leads to this book, right?
Yeah, I was not expecting this. And I met for the first time a woman engineer on this gas field. And I just hadn't seen somebody be in what was a very, very male-dominated profession. I'd seen women, be doctors and teachers because those were socially acceptable professions. And, as I say in the book, once she was seen, she could not be unseen. And I think that's what's happening for millions of young women and girls a couple of decades later, as they're seeing these new women joining the workforce and across a range of different professions.
The book is called 50 Million Rising. I want you to tell me, broadly speaking, obviously, who those 50 million are.
So about a decade and a half ago, across the entire Muslim world, there were only about 100 million women working. Today, that's 155 million women. Hmm. And so the title of the book is referring to the roughly 50 million plus that have joined the workforce in the last decade and a half.
What role in this rise do governments play in women being able to attain a meaningful place in the workforce?
You know, what's really interesting, one of the things that I found fascinating, much of it is organic. It's happening because these previous investments were made in education. But this shift that's happened in the last 15 years is by and large organic and not because of a top-down government policy. It's happened because technology has become a tool of work. There's the gig economy. People are using technology to create new kinds of platforms, and that is providing a very different type of flexibility. It's happening because of the globalization of ideas. So not just the globalization of goods and services, but ideas. And so for a lot of these young women, their role models are no longer just what their mothers have been doing or what is happening in their neighborhood or in their communities or schools, but actually they can look at what somebody on the other side of the world is doing. And then the third reason is economic necessity. It is just simply no longer possible for a middle-class family that has aspirations for its children in an urban area in much of the emerging markets of the Muslim world to live on a single income in any household.
There's a supply thing going on here, right? There's obviously a huge mass of women who want to, for all the reasons you've laid out, get into the workforce. Is there the commensurate demand from businesses and corporations and the economic system to have these women participate?
Yeah, in many ways, businesses seem to be ahead of governments in terms of recognizing the change that's happening. And that's because of two reasons. One, they've started to recognize the power of this market. So the combined earnings of these 155 million women across these 30 countries, it's $1 trillion. So it makes them approximately the 16th largest economy in the world if we were comparing them to economies. And so they're starting to think of them differently as a market. The second big reason is, across most of the Muslim world, in nearly every single country, there are more women coming out of university than men. And that's been the case for about 10 years or so now. So, for example, in Saudi Arabia, out of all of the women that could be going to university, 50% are. And that is higher than in China, in India, in Mexico, in Brazil. And so the base of the white-collar talent in particular is more female than it is male. And that's another thing that companies are starting to recognize. And they're starting to design their organizations to take this new influx of talent.
Does the pace of change give you pause at all? Because, a couple of decades in the grand scheme of things is really like the blink of an eye.
Yeah. Compared to where these countries were about a decade and a half ago, the shift is massive. It's a 50% increase compared to how many women were working before. At the same time, this is still only about 30% of the adult population in the 30 countries that I was looking at. A lot of the women that I was speaking to in these countries, they felt that they were probably a transition generation. They are doing something that their mothers and grandmothers would never have been able to do. And yet what they're really banking on is what happens to the generation after them. So what they're going to do in terms of investments in their daughters and a whole different set of aspirations that their daughters will have, and the very different views that their sons will have about what women can do, that's, I think, what's going to be the game changer in the future. And so there's every reason to believe that this trend will accelerate.
Sadia Zahidi is the head of education, gender, and work at the World Economic Forum. Her most recent book, first one, right? Your first book?
My first book?
First book. It's called 50 Million Rising. Sadia, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks, Kai.
This final note on the way out today, I'll be honest with you, it's a retread, which I first used after the shootings in Newtown 5 years ago, and then again after Orlando, and then again after Las Vegas, and now again, clearly today. Here it is. There are more retail shops in this country where you can buy a gun than there are Starbucks on the entire planet. Like I said, I hate days like today. All right, we got to go. Sarah Bruguiere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.